This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly design show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today...
There's so much more that things can be. They can be emotional, they can be political, and trying to split everything into a box of form or function is not really helpful.
Monocle's Robert Bound visits an exhibition on the intriguing intersection of beauty, craft and usefulness near Leeds. Plus, we splash across the channel to visit the latest opening of retailer extraordinaire Galerie Lafayette in Paris. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. The French department store Galerie Lafayette is a Parisian mainstay, and its glass atrium presides over wares from luxury brands including Louis Vuitton and Chanel. Now, Galerie Lafayette has opened a new space on the Champs-Élysées. Set in an Art Deco building that's steeped in family history, it was the work of Danish architect Bjarke Ingels to create a space that remained true to the brand's ethos while updating its image. Colette Davidson was at the new shop opening last week on our behalf, and she brings us this report.
The excitement is palpable out on the Avenue des Champs-Élysées as potential shoppers gather for the opening of Galerie Lafayette's new concept store.
I'm Roger and I'm from Taiwan. I think it's more about the history and the design.
My name is Claire and I'm from Victoria, British Columbia, Canada. I think in terms of the other location, the Galerie Lafayette on Boulevard Haussmann, there's so much history there and it's such an incredible building and it's kind of the go-to place for sort of a big shopping center but with some high-end stores. So it's such a wonderful location and store. We assume that this one will be great too here on the Champs-Élysées.
My name is Tessa and I'm from Paris. I think nowadays, especially this few last year, French are really attracted by shopping more and more made in France products that it used to be, because they want to come back to what we do in France in terms of quality as well. But also they are concerned about ecology, they are concerned about work conditions and everything. So buying clothes or accessories that are made in France, it more appeals to them. It makes more sense for them.
Shoppers have been waiting here since 10 this morning. By 11 o'clock, the crowds are building. By 11:30, store staff come and hand out branded fortune cookies to anxious shoppers. And then it's noon when the black steel doors are finally pulled open. Paris's mayor Anne Hidalgo, flanked by the Crown Princess of Denmark, is here to cut the inaugural ribbon before the crowds push forward to get inside. A half dozen mannequins draped in Chanel greet shoppers as the wide central staircase beckons upwards to the four interconnected floors. There are certainly echoes of the main Galerie Lafayette store here, like the glass atrium sparkling above and the spiral of opera-style balconies. But as the store's general manager, Nadia Duib, explains, the design of this new concept store is truly unique.
Actually, the design concept have been imagined by a great superstar architect called Bjarke Ingels with his agency BIG. This new generation of architects, once again, open-minded, and he has this philosophy which is pragmatic utopia. So it's having something very fluid to bring the flow and make it really go around the store, but also make it nice and create a gathering place. For example, we have those clusters, and those clusters are meant to not only to be stairs, but to be a gathering place. You can sit on them and enjoy the view and have a coffee from the Café Citron with Jacques Mus. From each floor, you can see what is happening. It's a store which is more in a human scale. We are 6,500 square meters, which is like, for us, only one floor of our main building. And here the scale is the product, the customer.
But the flagship store is more than just fashion and fun. It's also steeped in family history. Almost 100 years ago, the Galerie Lafayette founder, Théophile Bader, was planning to create a venue that would be at the crossroads of retail, services, and entertainment. But the project never panned out. This concept store is a way to revive Bader's original vision, says Duib.
Yeah, actually, there is a great history behind this project. It's a historic building. It have been aimed, and the founder of Galerie Lafayette wanted to build a store here in the 1930s. Unfortunately, the financial crisis didn't allow him to do it. He has to sell the land to the National City Bank of New York. So we had this beautiful Art Deco building. And the idea is having, with our architect, we thought a project that have to be organic, humble, and very preserving the history and bringing the newness in it. So the heart of the building is really related to the history, with the marble, with the columns. We even refurbished the floor. It's the authentic floor, original floor, and brought lots of modernity where actually there was nothing during the history of the bank. So this concrete floor here, the big windows, bringing the light inside the store, is really what brings the modernity of this concept and of this building.
It's that mix of past and present with a nod towards the future that's the goal of the concept store. Personal shoppers are at the ready to accompany clients who want a personalized experience, and all the products in the store are carefully curated. Whether it's that must-have luxury brand, a special collaboration, or a hard-to-find label, shoppers can be sure they're getting a truly unique offering. The layout of the space also works to promote each item. Purses fly by on a conveyor belt, while geometric silver shelves show off sunglasses. It's all in an attempt to attract a certain type of customer, according to Nadia Duib.
It's supporting the fashion. It's supporting customers that want to have a choice, that want to really be pleased during their shopping spree. They want to dream. They are fed up with boring retail. So it's more an idea of bringing here all what is relevant for the customer that we are aiming and targeting. And the customer that we are targeting, it's a cool, young, but young in mind, the mindset, and open-minded customer.
That ideal rings true for today's shoppers, who are not only coming to check out the latest brands, but the space itself. Parisian Romain says the store is an ode to the building's Art Deco origins and a way to pay homage to French savoir-faire.
It's really important because the Made in France trend is very strong right now. And it would be a shame to alter a building like this too much. This space is really beautiful. It used to be a Virgin Megastore, but it's been conceived of really well, both in terms of the lighting as well as the design itself. It's very user-friendly, and all of this on a beautiful avenue.
Galerie Lafayette looks set to think out of the box, something rare for a department store. Its new downsized store hopes to support innovation in fashion and design while remaining accessible to the consumer, all the while fulfilling the dream of its founding father to create a hybrid venue that sparks new life into the world of retail. For Monocle in Paris, I'm Colette Davidson.
And next up on the show, we're borrowing from a failed television format in which participants from one show inexplicably turn up in another show. And I'm joined here in Studio 2 of Midori House by the host of Monocle's Culture Show and Monocle Magazine senior editor, Robert Bound.
Hi, Josh.
Howdy. Harewood House is the place where you're going to take us with your rather wonderful report,
yeah.
Rob. There's been an exhibition up there hosted by a former Monocle parishioner and former host of this show, actually.
Indeed, yeah.
Hugo McDonald.
So this is Harewood House's inaugural Harewood Biennial. It is one of the 10 sort of key country houses of England, built in the early 18th century with money from the West Indies and the rum trade and the sugar trade and the rubber trade and all these things by the first Earl of Harewood. It is now lived in and administered by the 8th Earl of Harewood, who's quite a jolly chap. His wife, Denise, is an art collector, and they've got quite an eye on the contemporary. So this isn't the first foray into doing stuff that's not just about old brown furniture, Josh. It's quite a lot of gumption and guile and wit about the place.
Well, I think the interesting thing is that you might see the kind of exhibition that's entitled Useful, Beautiful, Why Craft Matters in a kind of white box of a gallery. Mm. I think the venue of a kind of country house speaks to partly that kind of rarefied era of design where it was for one family and it was about showing off to the other families. But how does opening up this space present an interesting curatorial challenge? And I guess it makes it a nice place to go to as well, doesn't it? Makes it a nice place to visit.
Yeah, well, Hugo's thing, Hugo McDonald, as you said, former presenter of this show, is the curator. He's a writer, curator, design consultant now. And his thing was, he said simply he wants to make people think as they walk around. Because you know what it's like. We've all done this when we were kids. We got probably hauled around by our parents or our aunts and things like that. You walk around these places and you kind of read the captions on the walls and you look at some old tapestries and some kind of bed that someone supposedly slept in before they were beheaded. It's the classic kind of country house stuff, right? This house, by the way, was designed by, it was John Carr, Robert Adam. Chippendale did all the furniture and he was a kind of young buck then. Capability Brown did the garden. It's all kind of, it's one of the sort of classic places. But even those wonderful people, these amazing friezes and the wonderful architecture, interior design, because they've become such a sort of light motif for oldness, we can't see anything maybe new in them. So this show, Hugo's show, Useful Beautiful, aims to show you some of the way that those people worked by showing you how people work now, kind of thing. So it's trying to pull a strand, a little red thread between the past and the present, and dare I say it, the future, because some of this stuff is really kind of wonderful. And it's, although some of it is ephemeral in thought, it is concrete in design.
We're going to hear your report in just a moment now, but I want to hear if any of the work of the, is it 26 craftsmen?
Yep.
Kind of made you feel a bit differently, kind of fulfilled Hugo's curatorial brief of making you kind of question the importance of craft or maybe seeing something beautiful in a space where you might have just seen it as old before.
Yeah, I think, well, you'll hear from a couple of people, a glass artist and a bookbinder in a minute. So you'll hear from them and what I thought about that in a sec. They were really cool people. I mean, we probably are familiar with Faye Toogood. Certainly listeners to this show will be. So she had a real kind of a bit of a sort of survey show in one of the, in a gallery space, which obviously was designed, first of all, for walking around and looking at yourself in the mirrors that were angled from the ceiling down towards you. That was what the English used it for. The Italians and French used it to hang paintings. This time it is used to look at sort of Faye's work, all sorts of stuff. And it is always on the cusp of that useful, beautiful thing. So tables that are sort of stunningly modern, yet actually very practical. Coats that you could never wear, but sort of show a construction process and a design process. So her stuff really stood out, and it had a great sort of long room in which to see how she worked, what she thought about things. She also made a work that mirrors one of the contemporary pieces in the Countess of Harwood's collection. She made a kind of witty response to that almost looks like a sort of samurai suit of armour at the other end of the room. So there were things that people very much, some of these artists and craftspeople, responded very precisely and wittily to the spaces in which they sat. So, I mean, that kind of ran through the whole thing. Another thing, there were kind of shells from the Second World War dug up around the area, and a Polish artist made them, as so many, you know, railings and pieces, beautiful pieces of you know, garden tools and stuff were melted down to make weaponry for the two world wars. This Polish artist, in a sort of act of remembrance, has turned those unexploded bombs, well, they've been exploded now, fortunately, into useful things, into garden tools and into kitchen knives and things like this, which is kind of a moving thing. There's a video of him doing it as well. I met him as well. He was a wonderful guy and a thoughtful guy. So that's the kind of stuff that we see there.
Well, we're going to hear now Robert Bound, Monocle's senior editor's report. Rob, thank you very much.
Thank you. Harwood House, just north of Leeds in Rowling, Yorkshire, is an 18th century masterclass in English country house class. Designed, built, decorated and zhuzhed by the Fabulous Four. John Carr, Robert Adam, Thomas Chippendale, Capability Brown. It's big, beautiful and old, but its age makes it static and country house stuff is very brown. But the current 8th Earl of Harwood is a bright spark and so are his people. So, to celebrate the great craft, design, artistry and skill that tends to waft around these places, up has popped the Harwood Biennial, the inaugural instalment of which is called Useful Beautiful: Why Craft Matters. And its curator is Hugo McDonald, a writer, curator and design consultant who eagle-eared listeners may remember was the first presenter of this very programme. McDonald paired 26 craftspeople to respond to and riff off the rooms of the great house in which their work sits. The idea, he said, was to get people simply to think as they walked about. The Harwood Biennial aims also to find out why the word craft is applicable to high-end design and to beer. I spoke to two of the craftspeople who made work for the show, Julie Bolaños-Derman and Kate Holland, but first the curator, Hugo MacDonald.
I'm Hugo MacDonald. I'm a curator and writer.
And you've created Youthful Beautiful here at Harwood House. It's the obvious thing to do, but tell us about the title of the show, because there always seems to be a tension in design about these two things, or even people's understanding of what those two things can mean in terms of furniture, making, craft, and design as a whole, Hugo.
Well, I chose the title Useful Beautiful, taking those words from the William Morris quote, "Have nothing in your house that you do not believe to be useful or know to be beautiful." What's the other way around?
Believe to be beautiful.
Exactly, I should probably get that right. But instead of asking people in the exhibition to judge whether the things on show are useful or beautiful, I hoped that people will see there's so much more that things can be. They can be emotional, they can be political, they can be economic, they can be sustainable. And trying to split everything into a box of form or function is not really helpful at all.
And we're used to country houses now, the Hepworth Sculpture Park. We're used to things being turned into art galleries, sometimes in a very traditional sense, showing oil paintings and Turner and things like this, sometimes now embracing contemporary art. These things aren't sort of surprising or shocking to us. But what's strange is the interiors of these houses, when they were designed, were useful or beautiful. There were a lot of debates about that at the time. It seems to be one of your intentions to kind of reignite some of those debates and ask people about the foundation of certain things, whether it's pattern, whether it's the very form and fabric of the house itself. Tell us about some of the ways or the approach to doing that that you seem to have taken.
Well, like you say, the interior here at Harwood is an incredibly richly layered example of British craftsmanship from the Georgian period and a little bit from the Victorian era as well. But really our intention with the exhibition was to try and help people engage with the house a little bit more consciously. We're used to walking around these spectacular, stately homes and gawping at the level of detail of the craftsmanship and the art on the walls. But we tend to think that it was a pinnacle and that it's been downhill ever since, and that we look but we don't touch. And with this exhibition, what we were very keen to try and do was to introduce exhibits to each of the rooms that helped people to engage with what exists in the house already. For instance, in the old kitchens, which has one of the largest collections of copper pans, I think, in the world, we have on the big table in the centre of the kitchen shown the process of how an iron pan comes into existence today. The hope being that people see the process of the pan and then look up at the copper pans and think, my goodness, all of these were made in this way 300 years ago.
And that sort of static reputation of the sort of country house, the National Trust or English Heritage Country House, or even the self-sustaining one, it's almost a running joke, actually. As you say, it's all about look and don't touch. There's a lot of tactility with a lot of the things that you've commissioned and curated here in this show. How new is this in the world of kind of country house curation? I wonder, are you pushing against an open door with this sort of thing? How much discussion has there been with what you can do and can't do with some of the historic rooms here at Harwood?
It's a bit of a thorny issue. Harwood is an accredited museum, and so everything in the house has museum status. You can't just walk into a room and move furniture. You have to get the curatorial team to come up with white gloves and move chairs. So installing an exhibition throughout the entire house has been a pain at times, to be completely honest. But it's also been a really fascinating challenge to work out what you can push and to work out actually where the red tape is that can be removed, and to help shift the mindset of the people who work here to think of the house as something living and not just something that needs to be preserved. You realise pretty quickly that there are rules in place that protect things for obvious reasons, but that those rules don't need to apply blanketly across the entire interior and its contents. And so we've played with that wherever possible, shifting things in and out of rooms, taking complete contents of furniture out of one room and laying down our rugs that have been created specially for the exhibition. And in those tweaks, I think that's also how you begin to enliven visitors' experience of the house. they come into these rooms expecting something and they see something unexpected, and it helps them then to question everything that they're looking at.
When you're putting a show together like this, you must see some wonderful kind of glimmers of sunlight through the clouds in terms of quality.
Absolutely. I think one of the stories that we've been most keen to tell throughout the exhibition is optimism. I think a lot of people assume that craft is dying, and obviously in some cases that is the case. But in every example of the crafts that we have in the exhibition, and that's 26 different makers, each one of them has such an optimistic story to tell. They have chosen to do what they do because they believe that it has a purpose in life today. They haven't just fallen out of bed and decided to weave baskets for a living. And that sense of optimism and the energy and the enthusiasm that they bring is quite a powerful collective message.
That was the curator of Useful Beautiful at Harwood House, Hugo MacDonald. The Puerto Rican glass artist Juli Bolaños-Derman worked with the shape of ornate perfume bottles that easily could have come from the 1920s when Princess Mary lived at Harwood House. And she displayed them in the princess's bathroom. They're witty, pretty and wise.
Hi, my name is Juli Bolaños-Derman. I'm a Costa Rican artist based in Edinburgh, Scotland.
And we walk through and we find, I think we're in a very specific part of the building of Harwood House here. This is St. Mary's bedchamber and chambers, but we're specifically in her bathroom, and your work riffs on that. There's a specific reason for why you're displaying your work here.
Yes, well, actually, this collection of 60 decorative sculptural perfume bottles was inspired by my grandma's dresser and how all of the different bottles were very beautifully put together. And this materialized into a collection of, by using discarded glass and blown pieces that were about to go to the bin, I embellished them, the different components, and play with them as if they were Legos to create these perfume-like objects.
From a first glance, these look like traditional perfume bottles. And you look at them and you go, okay, I've seen this before. But then you look at them again and you look closer. And as you say, you have tempered and messed around with and kind of made a witty diversion into these shapes. Talk us through some of these things, because some of them are slightly familiar.
Well, all of these are, I cannot do a straight line if my life depended on it. So I try to make an emphasis on that. And in the end, these happen to be put together like as if they look like tiny characters and they have postures and attitudes. So that's why from afar, you first see them and you're just like, oh, look, a very colorful collection of perfume bottles. But then once you come closer to it, you can see how each piece of the puzzle is intricately cut and it has like a detail which it becomes appropriate and creates like a character on its own. I like to bring the humor into it and invite the audience to have a bit of a laugh as well.
Yeah, and that seems like an idea of beauty and human fallibility.
Exactly.
In the way that you've made these things. Is that something, where did you start to become interested in that? When did that start to become a part of your practice?
I think that's always been a part of it. It's such a fragile material, and if something breaks, I'm just like, I give it a try, and that's fine. You just put forward whatever 50%, and whatever happens is out of your hands. So I try to trust in that process and not try to make myself tied to the object, but more about the enjoyment of the process. And this is just one of the 1 million elements of this miraculous process of just being able to create something on our own, and well, not on our own, but with your own two hands. Yeah.
That was Juli Bolaños-Derman. What a stunning accent. Puerto Rico, after 7 years in Edinburgh, will do that trick for you. Kate Holland is a bookbinder weighed down with awards for her incredible work. Kate made a book using all the traditional methods, a painstaking thing it is too, that referred to the old library in which it sat.
I'm Kate Holland and I am a bookbinder.
Kate, we're standing in front of one of your works here. It's very specific to the room it's in. Tell us a little bit about the story behind this and why we're standing in one of these grand libraries looking at a very rare book.
In the archives here at Harwood, there's a sketchbook by the plasterer Joseph Rose, who worked on all the Robert Adams ceilings, and it's got all the drawings of all the ceilings here at Harwood, but then also lots of the other houses around the country that Adam worked on. And I just thought this was the most wonderful, special piece of archive material more people should be able to see it. So I've created a facsimile of that book in a limited edition of 50. And of those 50, I've then made two specials. So they're covered in leather. I'm using gold. I'm using all the traditional materials and techniques as used by the binders who made the books in this room, in this library.
You are kind of embodying the thing you become interested in the cover and the artwork. It's an unusual process by which you're sort of immersing yourself in the spirit of something and bearing that out in the design. Is that right?
Yes, I think so. Someone said to me, you managed to get the soul of the book onto the cover. So it's, and it's not just the cover, it's also the M papers, the deblurs, the edges, the headbands. I think I worked out there's about 8 different planes on a book which I can express myself. I mean, this is slightly more decorative than normal, and quite often I'm interpreting a text and maybe bringing in contemporary issues that exist in a historical text and using imagery from contemporary. So, for instance, I've just done a first edition of The Grapes of Wrath, and I used an image from Dorothea Lange from the 1920s, Great Depression era, of a migrant mother washing. But then also alongside that, I had a Matthew Black, I think the name of the photographer is, who had taken a photograph in 2015, also of a migrant mother washing her clothes in a migrant camp. And so, you know, nothing has changed, basically, in that interim period. I'm very interested in highlighting those. I'm also really interested in how craft is just really important. It's really important for us as humans to be using our hands and not to remove ourselves and buy stuff from the other side of the world. It's important. I'm not saying go and buy really expensive handmade stuff to everyone, because obviously everyone can't afford it. But try and bring into your life a bit of making, whether it's, you know, making a meal from scratch. Just use your hands to do things. We've evolved as a species. We have opposable thumbs, and our hands are made to handle tools, and it's important that we use that.
Kate Holland there, closing the book on our short tour of Useful Beautiful at Harwood House. It's an amazing thing, full of clever ideas, wit and clarity, and usefulness and beauty come as standard. And it's on until the 1st of September.
Many thanks to Monocle's Robert Bound there for that report from the Harwood House Biennial, just outside Leeds. Useful Beautiful, Why Craft Matters is on until September this year. And sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show. Don't forget, if you need a little more design-minded inspiration, you could always subscribe to our brilliantly named sister podcast, Monocle on Design Extra. Do you get it? It's available each Thursday. You could also pick up a copy of the magazine, or why not brandish our Salone-themed newspaper for those of you interested in attending the Milan Furniture Fair. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the ever-patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.